Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Artificial intelligence already helps us solve many of our daily troubles, from face recognition on smartphones to fraud detection for our credit cards. But should AI be deciding what is true? As the technology has continued to expand its presence in our lives, an important question has emerged, especially on the eve of a presidential election season. What level of trust can and should we place in these AI systems? Well, here to explore the question is Dr. Brent Harrison, assistant professor in computer science at the University of Kentucky. Welcome, Dr. Harrison.
Hi there. Happy to be here.
Generative AI has begun to approach human-level intelligence and is becoming increasingly realistic with increasingly human-like features. In March, some prominent tech leaders signed a letter calling for artificial intelligence labs to put a foot on the brakes and stop the training of these most powerful AI systems, at least for a half a year or so. And they cited, quote, profound risks to society and humanity and concerns that artificial intelligence could take over, end quote. Other researchers and executives dismissed those fears as science fiction and overblown. On that scale, between fears of an AI takeover versus skepticism about that fear, where do you land?
I kind of land somewhere in the center. When I hear talks of an AI takeover, I think that can be true and not true at the same time. I don't think of it maybe in the classic science fiction sense of, oh, the Terminator is going to come and conquer us all. I think the real fear is just the unchecked spread of AI kind of in society. So when I hear, oh, there's fear of an AI takeover, it's more that it's going to be so useful, so popular, and we're seeing this now with ChatGPT, that it's going to spread to the point where we kind of can't put the genie back in the bottle. And so when I hear calls to pause for a little bit, that's more what I see as the potential benefit. We can stop and think, okay, what are the implications of this? It gives us a chance to think about that.
Some people are saying that people really should be less concerned with AI's theoretical existential threats and more concerned with its existing effects on the spread of disinformation or a perpetuation of biases. But don't we kind of need to keep a sharp eye on both?
I think we do, and I think a big immediate threat is in the spread of biases and misinformation, because that's stuff that's already out there. That's stuff that years ago, we in the AI research community kind of saw the potential there, and we saw examples of that happening. We saw examples of image classifiers that couldn't identify Black people. We saw examples of AI systems that were supposed to give bank loans that would bias against people in neighborhoods that were predominantly Black people or immigrants. And so these are things that were happening. And so that's kind of why whenever I talk about the risks of AI, I point to these examples because they're here. They're not, you know, theory. We've seen them. And most AI researchers are aware of them. And there is a community that's working to correct these things.
One of the articles I've read recently is that there is about the fact that there seems to be an explainability problem with AI understanding, even among experts. You're nodding.
I love this topic.
How many AI models, including GPT-4, make the decisions that they make?
Oh, they all make the decisions, 100%. However, if you ask the system to tell you why did it make this decision, can't do it. Cannot do it. Because these systems are huge. They're full of, they're big balls of math. Think of it that way. And so trying to demystify that, trying to open the black box, as it were, it's almost impossible to explain that to a person that doesn't have, you know, extensive computer science or AI training. And we've recently kind of looked into, well, what happens if you ask GPT-4 to, you know, you made this decision, why did you make this decision? It's just going to go back to that ball of math and kind of hallucinate, oh, well, here's possibly why I've made this decision. And so that's why there's a lot of work on You know, what does it mean to be explainable? How do we make these systems able to correctly and accurately explain what they're doing? And it's an incredibly difficult task because in addition to accurately reflecting the true decision-making mechanisms inside of the system, you have to do it in a way that people understand. And you mentioned trust, and I think explainability at a layman level is one of the ways that you foster trust.
Adobe, for example, has rolled out new capabilities for Photoshop that allows for the easy merger of reality and digital fakery and delivers to a large user base. The software allows anybody with a mouse and imagination and $10 to $20 a month to, without any expertise, subtly alter pictures, sometimes appearing so real that it seems likely to erase most of the remaining barriers between what is authentic and what is fake. The Pope in the puff jacket, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It won't alert you to every image that's fake, but instead can help you determine whether a certain image is authentic, which seems a little backwards. Anyway, in the future, you might see a snapshot of a car accident or heaven forbid, a terrorist attack or a natural disaster on Twitter and dismiss it as fake unless it carries a content credential that says how it was created and edited. But that's a big if. Is that going to be enough? Maybe it won't carry that credential.
I worry that it might not be enough. And then there's, God forbid, we end up in a situation where that credential itself becomes something that could be faked or somehow generated. What I would like to see is I see this entire thing of creating fake images, fake news stories, as an arms race between people that are designing the systems that can do this and the people that are designing the systems that can detect it. And at some point, I'd like to think that the detection systems will get so good that, great, this will be the way that we can go about it. However, we see this in security. If you design a better security system, someone is going to design a way around it, and that'll just kind of continue forever. However, oftentimes in cybersecurity, we reach an equilibrium. Sometimes the attackers get a little better. Sometimes the defenders are a little better. And that's kind of like, it's a pragmatic view of where I think things are kind of going. That's kind of the future I see.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier the tech execs who've called for applying the brakes, and we're kind of hearing that in Washington as well. But how realistic is that? Has this genie left the bottle?
I don't think anyone's going to stop training. That mm-hmm. the time for that passed a while ago. That's going to keep on going. However, I am encouraged by what some of the leaders of these big tech companies are saying. The CEO of OpenAI was at a congressional hearing, and his big message was, I agree, there does need to be something done here. There does need to be some regulation where the government can step in and work with these companies to come up with a way to encourage the growth of AI, do it in a way that is fair, unbiased, and still serves the American people.
Well, Elon Musk is in the game, and he says he's creating something called TruthGPT, and it's an AI chatbot that is perceived to be the voice of reason, the arbiter of truth. Others say trusting artificial intelligence to give us the truth is a pretty foolish bargain. What are the implications, though, of AI for trust in human interaction?
So the problem there is, and this is true of all machine learning systems. Machine learning systems, like these large language models, they're mirrors. They're mirrors that you hold up to the data that was used to train it. And so saying that a model is the absolute arbiter of truth, in my opinion, is impossible because the data that you use to train it is going to be biased. It's not going to be perfect unless you spend a lot of time and a lot of money, which I'm pretty sure nobody has done, to ensure that everything you get is 100% factual. And even then, I'm pretty sure a historian would come in and could argue that things that appear to be 100% factual are actually much more complex than that. So I think it's unreasonable to say that, yes, I have designed the machine learning model, the large language model that is the arbiter of truth. No, you've created a model that now is giving you perhaps different biases or different things. And to say otherwise is a little much for my tastes.
Well, here's another wrinkle. OpenAI decided to test the safety of its new GPT-4 model, gave it the latitude to interact on the internet and resources to achieve its goal. And at one point, the model was faced with a CAPTCHA that it couldn't solve. So it hired a worker on TaskRabbit to solve the puzzle. When questioned by the worker, "Are you a robot?" the GPT-4 reasoned that it shouldn't reveal that it was an AI model, so it lied, claiming that it was a human with a vision impairment. The worker then solved the puzzle for the chatbot. GPT-4 had used deception to achieve its goal. That, to me, is really scary.
It is, but I don't think it did that. Like, I don't think it actually reasoned about, I need to lie to do this. I think what it saw was the following. It said, in my training data, other people, when faced with CAPTCHAs that they couldn't solve, went to a service in order to find somebody to solve it. When asked if they were a robot, so, and then these are human examples they're getting these from, when asked if they were a robot, they responded, of course I'm not. I'm a person. And so it mimics that behavior. And so it's not necessarily thinking I need to lie to deceive. It's just, oh, well, in all the data I've seen, this is merely the process I follow when faced with this question. And that, depending on how you look at it, might be even more scary because, again, it's just mimicking things. And so when you want to ascribe all of these big and fancy and complex, you know, thought processes to the system, at the end of the day, it really is just very, very fancy mimicry.
So can anybody with access to an AI system inject bias into training data or models to meet a particular end?
Oh boy, yes. It has gotten harder, but that's the risk with any of these types of systems. I use this example all the time. It's an old example, but it is a very powerful one, I think. And that is Microsoft had a Twitter bot named Tay that they put online. It was a chat bot, and it was meant to learn how to converse with people. And the internet figured that out, and it did not take very long for them to... Well, for a group of people on the internet to intentionally bias the types of conversations that Tay was having. Essentially, Tay turned into a racist and started spouting hate speech because it was generating examples based on tweets that it was getting. And that was enough to bias the language that it generated. So, yeah, it is possible to bias these data sets. Now, a lot of times for the big, like, GPT models, their data sets, their training sets are under lock and key. And they recognize that, oh, this is where all the power comes from. So you don't really have access to it. However, you could find these open source large language models, fine tune them on your own data set of anything. And then there you go. You have a biased language model that does what you want it to do. So, yeah, that is a little scary.
Well, we have a big election coming up, the 2024 presidential race, and we know that real human voices can be cloned and using text-to-speech technology be made to say anything that you can type into the program to make them say. Do you have concerns about how AI will be used in this upcoming election season?
I do and I don't. I have concerns that misinformation can be generated using these systems. However, I think what's the scariest thought to me is if you have somebody that's smart enough to make an untrue message that is still believable enough to be, you know, passed off as truth. A lot of times with these systems, if they're just regular people that are spreading messages, a lot of times you can look at things and be like, okay, yeah, that's not real because it's too outrageous. Although maybe recently that's hard to tell. But if somebody were clever enough to pass off a, you know, something that could be true, might not be true, the real fear there is that, yeah, now we can't really tell the difference. And I don't think systems for detecting this type of misinformation are quite there yet.
The White House Office of Science and Technology Policy has released a national AI R&D strategic plan that outlines key priorities and goals for federal investments in AI research and development. But is this a little late in the game? And with much of this technology out there on the internet, is there really much that any one country can do to rein it in?
So I'm happy that they're doing what they're doing. I read over this earlier today, and I was fully expecting it to seem kind of a little out of touch, because a lot of the ways that the government has interacted with technology have felt that way, especially with social media. But honestly, what I saw there was incredibly thoughtful, and I think moving in the right direction. It didn't spout off fears of, or kind of alarmist fears of, oh, you know, we have to rein things in because AI is taking over. It seemed to prioritize identifying ways to continue this development, again, while helping people. And I think it kind of comes back to the old adage, the best time to do something was yesterday, but the second best time is right now. And so I'm happy that they're doing something, you know, they're at least talking about things at this stage rather than letting things continue on. So could it have been earlier? Sure. But I'm glad that they're doing something now.
It's Dr. Brent Harrison, assistant professor in computer science at the University of Kentucky. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's been a big and important shift in a weather system that reliably produces severe events. Jerry Brodsky serves as the state climatologist of Kentucky and director of the Kentucky Climate Center, as well as director of the Kentucky MesoNet, and he is professor of meteorology at Western Kentucky University. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Dr. Brodsky.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Yes, and I'd like to begin by getting your take on an article by Mark Fischetti. He's senior editor at Scientific American. And to paraphrase, he's telling us that while tornadoes touch down in many places across the eastern half of the country, from the 50s through the 90s, they were most often concentrated in what's known as Tornado Alley, mostly northeastern Texas, south central Oklahoma. Now, it seems that Tornado Alley has shifted eastward by 400, 500 miles, spilling into western Kentucky, as well as Tennessee, Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama. So a new region of these concentrated storms. Does your research and your data confirm that finding?
Well, it does. I would probably phrase it maybe a little differently than the article did. If you look back in Kentucky history, we've always had tornadoes. And in fact, the term Tornado Alley is a little misleading, because it kind of gives you this picture of, you know, Kansas with tornadoes, which they get. You know, you think of Wizard of Oz, you think of the Flat Plains, and you think of tornadoes, you generally think of the plains, but not Kentucky. But we've always had them. The south, southern states have always had them. Indiana's and the northern central part, the Midwest, has always had tornadoes. But as the article points out, what we are seeing, especially in the last 20 to 30 years, is more frequent tornadoes further east, meaning Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Indiana, and fewer tornadoes in the traditional plain states of Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas. And you could call this a shift east in Tornado Alley. I don't think that's an unfair assessment. You know, the tornado capital is still going to be Oklahoma. It's still going to be the plains. But what we are seeing in the data is fewer tornadoes compared to what it was 30 years ago, say, across the plains, and probably more tornadoes here in Kentucky.
Data gathered in the past couple of years, according to Scientific American, evidently show that in addition to solo storms, large outbreaks of tornadoes, multiple twisters created by a single weather system, also seem to be shifting more definitively eastward. Is that true?
It is. As you correctly point out, this article shows that we are indeed having possibly more outbreaks now than before. In fact, if you look at the number of days with multiple tornadoes recorded, that number is going up in this region.
Are they happening earlier in the season?
What we are seeing is a higher risk for tornadoes now, particularly in the spring and fall, compared to, say, historically what we've been used to. So here in Kentucky, we're used to strong storms in the spring. we might be seeing a few more of those, but we're not as used to seeing them in, say, October, November, December, as we have been in the past. And of course, you just go back a couple of years, and of course, we had the outbreak in 2021, and that was December, much later than we're used to seeing strong storms. But maybe that'll become maybe a little more normal going forward.
Why is this shift happening now? What's driving this?
Well, when we look across America, it looks like we're seeing two trends that may be contributing. One is the southwestern part of the country has been dry for really since 2000. And in that dry air over New Mexico, Arizona, that creates a very large warm layer of air that drifts to the west, to the east. And that creates what we call a lid, which suppresses storms across the plain states. And so that's kind of maybe the driver for why we're seeing fewer tornadoes across the plains. Here in Kentucky, we're seeing maybe the influence of the Gulf. The Gulf of Mexico is warmed recently, and that warm air from the Gulf creates a lot more moisture that's available for storms across Kentucky. And so between those two trends, really the Southwest warming up, creating a lid, maybe suppressing some storms across the plain states, but then we have the Gulf and more moisture and heat coming up from the Gulf that may be contributing to more storms across this part of the country.
Kentucky State climatologist Dr. Jerry Broski. Thanks so much, Jerry.
Thank you, Tom. Just like a tornado.
Love can really start. Sometimes it's what you discover along the way as you take a journalistic journey into a given subject. That happened to our own Crystal Jones while working on a story about cooperage, the business of making wood barrels.
While doing research for an upcoming episode about the cooperage industry in Kentucky, I've been surprised by the far-reaching effects of its presence. One particular angle of this story has a lot to do with oak trees. They're the root, if you will, of the cooperage industry, as white oak is the most coveted wood for making bourbon barrels. So highly desired, in fact, that with resources in question and ever-growing demand, circumstances have created an increase in the number of tree theft cases in the U.S., particularly in eastern Kentucky. This information felt important not only in reference to the upcoming episode, but it could be useful right now to some of our listeners.
It's important from the standpoint of the individual. Right? If you got your timber stolen, one tree or, you know, 10 acres or whatever, that is, you know, that's a significant issue for you. It's not a particularly significant issue for the total wood supply, but it's very important for an individual.
So this week, I spoke with Dr. Jeffrey Stringer, Chairman, Department of the Forestry and Natural Resources, University of Kentucky. I wanted to know who was taking the trees and why, and what Kentucky landowners can do to prevent tree theft from happening on their forest land.
Timber theft is a problem that goes on in every state. I believe a lot of it has to do with the fact that the topography is very rough. There's a lot of absentee landowners. There's a lot of property that's not easily visible to the public.
Kentucky first passed legislation in 1956, making it an offense punishable by fines and jail time. But in 2017, an amendment was made that stated if the trees were to be taken in, quote, a good faith mistake, it wasn't theft. Stringer clarifies.
Well, so timber theft is where there's an intent to steal. Somebody knows where a boundary is, a boundary line is, and they purposely cross it, right, to go with the purpose of stealing some of these trees. Timber trespass is a situation where there is an unauthorized cutting of trees, right? But it's not intentional.
Timber theft doesn't seem like an easy task. You would need the right tools for the job, knowledge of where to find the trees, and then a place to sell them.
There is no VIN number on a log, but a logger would go in and make an agreement with the landowner to cut their timber, right? So they cut their timber. When they show up at the mill is going to buy those logs. So you can have somebody that has stolen logs that just takes it to a mill and sells the logs. Just like the next load that comes in from a logger that's logging legal, he sells their logs. So there's no black market because there's no tracking of the logs back to the forest.
As it turns out, most incidents of suspected tree theft are actually trespasses. and are due to unclear or disputed property lines.
62% of the cases of unauthorized cutting was basically due to landowners not knowing where their boundaries or misrepresenting them.
So what can landowners do to protect themselves from this type of situation?
So the best way to protect yourself, right, is there's two things, really. One is know where your boundary lines are, so you can get a survey done and then mark your boundaries. Landowners can help themselves if they're aware of their property, right, and spend time and familiarity and overseeing their property. You know, if you don't show up on your property for 20 years, somebody else will probably be using it for something. Yeah, so the state of Kentucky has the Kentucky Division of Forestry. That's a state agency. One of their services they provide free of charge to landowners in the state, woodland owners in the state, is they will have a service forester, right, will be able to come out and develop a management plan. We call it a stewardship plan for that woodlands based on the landowner's objectives.
If you'd like to know more about the subject of tree theft and prevention, we have details and links on our Facebook page at Eastern Standard. Subscribe on the NPR or WEKU 88.9 app and catch our full episode on the cooperage industry airing soon. For Eastern Standard, this was Crystal Jones.
Crystal will be back with more on the oak barrel business in Kentucky next week when we look at a controversial U.S. Forest Service management plan for the Jellicoe Mountain portion of the Daniel Boone National Forest. Another episode of Rise, our documentary series, coming next week here on Eastern Standard. Coming up after the break, 2022 Kentucky Teacher of the Year Willie Carver on being driven out of the profession.
I am from Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and met the President of the United States. My school didn't even mention it in an email.
And Lexington author Janet Holloway, out with her latest revolving around lessons of entrepreneurialism learned at the feet of one very strong West Virginia grandmother.
She and her siblings began developing and selling moonshine.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The Olive Hill Center for Arts and Education presents On With the Show, 6 p.m. Friday, June 30th. For information and to purchase tickets, visit ohcae.org. Musical duo and Winchester natives Theo and Brenna will perform 7:30 p.m. Saturday, June 10th at the Leeds Theater in downtown Winchester. For information and to purchase tickets, visit leedscenter.org. Josh Turner will perform at the Mountain Arts Center in Prestonsburg, 7:30 p.m. Friday, June 16th. For information and to purchase tickets, visit macarts.com. And the Kentucky Arts Council's traveling exhibit, Continent to Commonwealth, is open to the public at the State Capitol in Frankfort through June 15th. For information on how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
What is it like to be a person who is somewhere on the LGBTQ spectrum of sexual or gender identities growing up and working as a teacher in Kentucky? Willie Carver, until recently an English teacher in Mount Sterling, can tell you plenty about that. In fact, this award-winning 2022 Kentucky Teacher of the Year has written a book about it. A graduate of Morehead State University, Willie's works have been published in Kentucky Teacher, Education Week, and Ed Post. His story has been featured on NBC, PBS, and NPR. Willie Carver is author of Gay Poems for Red States, being released on June 6th. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Willie, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you so much, and it's absolutely a pleasure to be here.
And if you would, please tell us about your book.
Sure. It's called Gay Poems for Red States. I basically had some things happen to me after I became Teacher of the Year with some community attacks. And what I actually sat down to write an angry letter to my superintendent, but instead I wrote a poem. And that poem was from the voice of a very small child. And what I found is over the course of the next few months, I wrote a lot of things from the voice of that small child. And soon I had an entire collection of works that sort of looked at what he wanted to say about school, about being queer, and about growing up in Appalachia.
Would you say that this was an act of catharsis?
Oh, it is the definition of catharsis for me.
Well, last May, I believe it was, you went to Washington, D.C. to testify about academic censorship before the House Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and we have the testimony. Let's listen to a portion of your remarks.
Few LGBTQ teachers will survive this current storm. Politicizing our existence has darkened schools. I am made invisible. We lost our textbooks during lockdown, so I co-wrote and found free printing for two textbooks, and I wasn't allowed to share them. Other schools celebrate similar work, but my name is a liability. I am from Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and met the President of the United States. My school didn't even mention it in an email. This invisibility extends to all newly politicized identities. Our administrator's new directive is nothing racial. Parents now demand alternative work when authors are Black or LGBTQ, and we are told to accommodate them, but I will not ethically erase Black or queer voices. We ban materials by marginalized authors, ignoring official processes. One parent complaint removes all students' books overnight. Students now use anti-LGBTQ or racist slurs without consequence. Hatred is politically protected now. My Gay Straight Alliance, or GSA, a campus group dedicated to LGBTQ issues and safety, couldn't share an optional campus survey with classmates. I was told it might make straight students uncomfortable. When posters were torn from walls, my principal responded that people think LGBTQ advocacy is, quote, being shoved down their throats. Inclusive teachers are being thrown under the bus by the people driving it.
So what was that like for you, Willie? What was the response?
The response was overwhelmingly positive. Hundreds of people from around the world wrote to me. They told me their stories. They told me their pain. They told me their hopes. And it was simultaneously very uplifting, but it was also painful to sort of to hear the things that people were going through. But hearing them express it gave me hope because it meant that they weren't holding it in anymore. So I was very proud to sort of use my experience as some sort of catalyst for other people to speak.
Well, as you stated in your testimony before Congress, last year you were named Kentucky Teacher of the Year, and only months later you decided to leave the public school system, and that must have been difficult. Why? What happened to drive the Kentucky Teacher of the Year out of school?
I think the short answer is I did not think my presence was helping students or making them safer anymore. The community attacks started with me. So I had people, it's the same narrative we're hearing nationwide now, but I was one of the first that I was a groomer, that somehow my very existence as a gay teacher was dangerous or harmful or inappropriate. Then those people started targeting my now former students, sharing pictures of them online at their after school job, suggesting that the students themselves were groomers. And I begged for help. Parents begged for help. The school, I think we're at a moment in our society where we're treating the worst of voices, most hateful actions, as if they're somehow politically on par with what we used to consider actual decency. And so the school refused to support the students, to deny the allegations. And so on the one hand, I didn't want my students seeing someone who was going through a lot of emotional problems as the only example of what queer adulthood might look like. And on the other hand, I think my very presence in the school could potentially cause them harm, and I didn't want to continue that.
The Kentucky General Assembly this year passed Senate Bill 150. Governor Beshear vetoed it, but the legislature's Republican majority voted to override that veto. And the bill is to take effect in late June, although immediately after its passage, the ACLU promised a court fight. And we don't yet know how that will turn out. So what in the meantime are the impacts of the legislation, regardless of whether or not it's being challenged?
When you have legislation like this, it's the same as what we're seeing in Florida with the Don't Say Gay bill. The issue is that it doesn't define its own terms. We don't really know what instruction about LGBTQ issues is, but what it's going to result in is entire silencing. And as someone who sat through situations his entire life in which the idea that he could speak who he was a problem. I know the mental health effect that it's going to have on young people, and it's going to be stark. That's just the school application of it. When we look at healthcare, it's really dangerous. This is why every single major medical association in the entire United States is against bills like this, because what we know is that there is healthcare that is proven to help students who otherwise could be suicidal or have suicidal ideation. The sort of thing that they're banning is incredibly rare, but when it needs to happen, it's very helpful. So the effects are going to be that we're going to see lots of I personally believe we're going to see LGBTQ suicide. And I hope we don't. I hope there are teachers putting up the good fight. But in order to help those students, those teachers have to break the law.
Well, let's turn to your book, Gay Poems for Red States. And I wonder if you could read a passage for us.
I'd love to. This entire collection, like I said, was written from the perspective of a young version of me. Sometimes I wanted to edit him, and he would just stand in front of the words and refuse. So this one's called Waiting for God. I was excited and nervous to be baptized because I thought it would make me brand new, like a toy still tied up and glued to its packaging, and also keep me from going to hell. In the 3 days until my baptism, I still had fifth grade homework. And on a Thursday evening, salted thick with dogwood and cool spring air, my mom joined me. We stretched out on the tired hood of her car under the Gregorian hum of a crackling housing project parking lot streetlight so that I could color in the phases of the moon with a pencil. She brought out a blanket and even let me sip some weak black coffee. "Do you think God will wait until Sunday before the end of the world? What if he came tonight and I went to hell?" She brought the cover around my shoulders and her frayed and overworked arms anointed the bargain bin blanket with the power to embrace me. She gestured upwards. "The same God that put them stars in the sky didn't do it so he could send you to hell. He holds them up for a reason, and he'll wait on you." The dark sky became an aquarium of sparks and love, and every fish had a name. Those 3 days stretched into 3 decades. Despite the baptism, preachers and lawmakers and winners and losers and lovers and haters and people with tongues and arms hot like red irons would over and over again hold my head underwater, hoping that the metal hiss of steam would mock me as I drowned. But with each plunge under, the darkness of the water would part, and fish made of stardust would lay hands on me and dance in the spirit.
Well, that's moving, to say the least. I have a quote here. "For those having trouble being seen and those having trouble seeing, this book is a blueprint for their shared survival." And the author Robert Kipe wrote that about Gay Poems for Red States. What do you think he was talking about?
One, Robert Kipe is an angel on this earth. Two, I think there's so much noise this day and age, particularly, that it's almost impossible to shake ourselves in front of it. And these young kids need to be seen, need to be heard. I think their lives depend on it. And I frankly think that all of our lives depend on it. If we want to be good, decent, moral people, and I know Kentuckians, I know Americans, I've been all over the world, I know people want to be good, we have to see each other. So I hope he was pointing to the idea that someone reading this book might understand those kids that they otherwise aren't seeing because of the noise, and that maybe those kids can see themselves.
The University Press of Kentucky, which is publishing the book, says this is more than a collection of poetry, that it's for those wishing to discover and understand the vastness of Appalachia. What will we find out about Appalachia that we might not be aware of?
What a great question. I think queerness and Appalachianness sometimes seem to be divergent points, but in my mind, they're the same thing. I grew up with people talking about what was queer and what wasn't queer. And so I always say, I'm queer and Appalachia's queer. It's weird. It's stubborn. You know, if we look at the oldest definition of queer from the 1600s, the whole concept is intentionally resistant. And what is Appalachia if not intentionally resistant? We've had 400 years to acclimate to the rest of the country, and we have no intention of doing so. I think there's a lot of resistance in here, and I think there's a blending of queer identity and queer identity that really shows that there's not a big difference for me in the two.
You're now a student support services at the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. What are you learning about campus attitudes toward LGBTQ people?
You know, I would say that young students on campus have the same attitudes as people, the young students in high school, which is that this is a fight that they're already past. It is not a problem for them. I couldn't cite the number. I would say 1 in 20 students has an issue with it, but overwhelmingly, no one has a problem. They're open-minded, and they're comfortable with themselves in terms of who they are as young men and women. And I think older generations, mine included, are not comfortable with their own sense of masculinity. You know, we were raised by baby boomers or the silent generation who were much more confident, especially the silent generation. And I think we have an entire generation that is sort of performing a lot more, trying to convince themselves. And so I think seeing young people who are not obsessed with this question threatens them. So these young people are not obsessed with this question.
Well, what can you say to young people who might be listening about the lessons of your experiences?
Emotions are real. You are going to be angry. And maybe you're going to want to cuss, and maybe you're going to want to cry. Do both. But keep your head up. You are going to survive whatever moment you're in. Remember that. You are going to offer things to the universe that you can't possibly imagine yet. I am 40 and just discovering things that I can offer, and I'm discovering that there are lots of unknowns still for me. So keep that in mind. Remember what a gift you are.
All right, that's Willie Carver, 2022 Kentucky Teacher of the Year, author of Gay Poems for Red States, coming out on the University Press of Kentucky imprint. Thank you so much, Willie.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Tom Eblin is back with the latest in his series all about the works of Kentucky writers.
Janet Holloway is a writer, speaker, teacher, mentor, entrepreneur, and business development consultant in Lexington. She was a founder of Women Leading Kentucky, a nonprofit organization that provides scholarships and leadership opportunities for women. Holloway is also the author of two engaging memoirs about her hardscrabble upbringing in rural West Virginia, Leaving and a Willful Child. She has just published a third book titled Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do. This memoir is a bit different, though. It is a mix of fact and fiction, a collection of stories about her and her family, in which her grandmother is a central character. This book is both poignant and hilarious, sometimes at the same time, and it is filled with colorful characters you will not soon forget. Here to talk with us about Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do is Janet Holloway. Janet, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, tell us a little about your grandmother and the place where you grew up in West Virginia.
Well, my grandmother was born in 1900, lived out on a farm in Virginia near Abingdon, a tobacco farm with her 7 or 8 brothers and sisters and her family. When her father died, she inherited the farm because she was the oldest in the family. And she became the matriarch of that family, making sure people lived a decent life and had enough food on the table and a place to live. During the Depression and when Prohibition was enacted, she realized that farming was not going to make a living for the entire family. And so she and her siblings began developing and selling moonshine, as a lot of people did in those days.
See, a proud Appalachian tradition.
Appalachian tradition. Her siblings made it, and she took it to Chicago and Cleveland and places like Bristol, Tennessee, and made a good living that helped support her family. Over time, she married, and I have to tell you one little anecdote, mm-hmm. is that her husband, when they were in Chicago selling moonshine, went out for razor blades one night and never came back. And they never knew what happened to him. And I always found that really interesting. And people have asked me to say more about it, but I don't know more. No one knows more about it, whether he was alive or dead or what happened to him. They said it went along with the moonshine business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually she had come to West Virginia, and many of her siblings followed. And she was quite an entrepreneur. She had a third grade education, but very bright, very sharp. And she bought some land from the trustees of Devil Aunts Hatfield. And it was bottom land on one side of the creek and a little flat place over on the left-hand side of the creek. And she built on top of what Devil Aunts had built as a cinder block building where he would throw his sons in there when they got drunk and or were making trouble.
And this is the Hatfield of the Hatfield and McCoy's fame.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. The real legit thing. And she built on top of that a residence with about 5 bedrooms, a small kitchen and bathroom and a living room. Living room was lit by the neon sign outside that said Pioneer Inn and Beer Garden. So she had a beer garden that she ran and did very well with. They could sell 3% beer. But what she sold in the back was never discussed. And she was smart enough in her time that she paid off the sheriff and his guys to leave her alone.
Now, you grew up with her a lot of your childhood.
She helped raise me, really.
Right.
There were many times when my parents separated. It was an awkward marriage, to say the least. So my mother would often take off, and I would be left with my grandmother, either on the farm or at the beer garden where we lived upstairs, and loved her dearly. She was the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about your decision to mix kind of memoir and fiction in this book, because, you know, some stories are memoir, and some you took a lot of license and really made short stories with these characters.
Yeah. Well, Tom, after I finished Leaving, the second book, these characters still played in my head, and I couldn't get them out of my head. And I thought, well, I don't know that much about them. I know their personalities. I know how they would act in certain situations. So I thought I would take the liberty of calling it autobiographical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The characters are real. They are behaving in ways that I think are real. And the situation is made up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've captured the character of these people.
Well, how has writing these three books kind of helped you make sense of your childhood and really shape your life going forward?
Well, that's a good question. The first book, Willful Child, was of my growing up until I went to college. And so my mother and father separated many times, quite often, and my father always took her back. And so it was a very upsetting, restless kind of childhood with them for me and my brother. So I stayed with my grandmother as much as I could. And that's how that connection grew.
What are some of the ways that that her personality and her accomplishments and drive kind of really shaped you as a business person and then maybe later as a writer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did see her doing business. And I, you know, even as a youngster, 10 or 11 years old, I was able to work the cash register and make change and sell sodas, not beer, but mm-hmm. And she had other groceries in the place. And one of the things she said to me early on, and I was about 11 years old, was a girl from West Virginia's got three choices. She can get pregnant, she can get religion, or she can leave. And she pointed her finger at me and said, I hope you know the one to choose. Well, I knew getting pregnant was not even possible. She'd lock her door on me. I tried getting religion, and I kept, as we would say back in the Pentecostal world, I kept backsliding, I guess, because I kept getting baptized over and over in the creek or in the church pool or whatever. But, you know, that and going to college and reading French philosophers and things like that, I realized that it had to be more than religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took her message about getting out, and I'd watched her do amazing things, you know, that she certainly wasn't trained for.
Right.
But she was very smart business-wise, and she was always negotiating with people about prices and whether it was tobacco or moonshine or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's the last story in the book, Salvation. And I don't know whether this is fact or fiction about she moving to Florida and sort of getting religion. Tell us a little about that one.
Well, she did. At about 75, I think it was, or 70, she moved to Florida, got out of the beer business, and one of her sisters followed and lived nearby. And so there was not much to do. And I remember some of this, but some of it is also made up. She did get religion was happy about that. And so I was trying to conceive of a time when she was being courted, if you will, to become a member of the church. And she went to a singing convention and was overcome by the heat. Mm-hmm. And someone in the church thought she had gotten the spirit. And so they all started screaming and yelling and crying and thank you, Jesus. And she didn't quite know what was happening. And as they swarmed around her and were happy for her, she was like, let me out of here. Let me get out of it. I don't know what these people are doing to me. And eventually the minister went to see her and said, well, since you were saved, as he thought, wouldn't you like to get baptized in the river? And she thought about it, and she thought about how hot it was, and she says, might as well do that. And I don't think that actually happened, that actual creek baptism. But I could imagine her doing it to cool off. And she's saying, this is wonderful. And the preacher is saying, another soul for Jesus. You know, it's like, but she went along and did eventually become a member of the church.
What advice would you have for others who want to kind of write about and remember and process experiences they've had in a book or in articles?
Well, it was very cathartic. The first book in particular, I mean, that was a tough book to write. In this one, I just had to pay attention to what these people would say and do. And as I thought about it, almost when I was finished, I realized my family, for the most part, is gone. You know, my parents, my grandmother, the relatives and all. And it was my way of saying, you were very important in my life and I loved you. And I think that's the reason I wanted to do that. Yeah. And I think other people could do it for the same reasons, to tell their story, to have the catharsis, and also the joy of reliving life with them.
Well, the book is called Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do by Janet Steele Holloway. Janet, thanks for being with us today.
You're very welcome, Tom.
For WEKU's Eastern Standard, this is Tom Eblin with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Crystal Jones, general assignment reporter, Chris Begley, special topics reporter, Ella Fitzgeraldine, our increasingly famous studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and much more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.